Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street right here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. In the second half of today's show, we travel to the Klamath River, where the largest dam removal in U.S. history is already breathing new life into the water and restoring salmon runs, an inspiring win for Indigenous-led environmental justice. Then we turn to school lunchrooms and farm fields as Harvest Public Media reports on the sudden end of USDA local food programs and how Midwest communities are scrambling to fill the gap. Plus, In Session brings us a legislative roundup. Charter schools, library access, and the fate of public notices in newspapers are talked about. And finally, This Week in Water shows us how butterflies and beetles are helping bridge U.S.-Mexico environmental cooperation. And we begin Main Street today with Patrick McCloskey. He is the editor of the Dakota Digital Review, and we visit with him each time a new publication comes out, and now's the time. Patrick, welcome back to Main Street.
Well, thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Remind us what the Dakota Digital Review is.
The Dakota Digital Review is published by the North Dakota University System. It's part of the Dakota Digital Academy. We got our inspiration and leadership from Mark Hagerot, the departing chancellor, to do a publication that covers digitization, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and everything connected to that and all of the social, political, economic, military implications. So it's pretty broad because, you know, technology sounds narrow, but it touches everything. Instead of having journalists who I couldn't afford to pay anyway, I ask experts to write in the publication. Many of them teach at the universities in the system, meaning NDSU, UND, Bismarck State College, et cetera, et cetera. I even have a student in this issue. And Mark Mills always has an article, and he's an internationally known writer. But his background is in physics, so he's actually an expert, not just a writer. And I help people learn how to write for a more general audience than an academic audience.
So what you mean by that is that I can be a high schooler and mm-hmm. understand this. I don't need a degree in cybersecurity or computer science.
No.
And the best thing is, it's free.
Publication is free. My mentorship is free. And yes, you could be a high school student. In fact, there were two 10th or 11th graders who co-wrote an article with some UND professors, and we're just waiting for that to be published to work with them to get it done. So it's expertise. You know, you could have 10 degrees, or you could be the janitor. As long as you've developed expertise in an area and you want to write about it, could be that your own personal hobby, could be that you're an expert in industry, could be that you've earned it academically.
We have a lot to cover in the current issue, and I want to give our listeners a flavor of what they can expect. So let's march down the list. The first article that they would read if they were to download the Dakota Digital Review, and it's called Nuclear Now by Mark Mills. There's a resurgence in nuclear interest. Is that why you had this article written?
There's not only a resurgence of interest, there's an imperative to do it. Mark wrote it several issues ago. He wrote an article about green energy, and he's written a couple of other ones in that arena. Number one, green energy is not any cleaner than fossil fuels to begin with. The net gain in CO2 is only 6% with like an EV car versus a regular car. As much as there's been an increase in, you know, solar wind batteries, all that's done is kept its small share. Most of the world's energy is still coming from fossil fuels. However, long term, we need to transition into nuclear because it's the only known, really reliable, safe, abundant, and very low cost energy.
Well, he also makes the case that wind and solar cannot keep up with the demand.
No.
That AI and other things are going to require.
No, and the demand isn't just a 45 degree angle. It's going up. You know, and as Mark starts out the article, it's, you know, we started down this road 70 years ago with President Eisenhower, you know, and calling Adams for peace, you know, calling for nuclear energy, and a number of plants were built. And then we had the Three Mile Island, a few other things that.
I enjoyed that refresher of history.
But no one's ever been killed by these accidents. The technology is so much better now. And Chernobyl was just bad, you know, that was a human error and bad design, and they didn't put a dome on the thing in the first place. So the technology has gotten much, much better, and the need for the we haven't begun even with India and all these other countries coming online and the energy demands they're going to have, and the need for, and right now we have the technology being developed where You could have these, you know, mini nuclear things that would fit into a container, you know, for example, and run a neighborhood, run a city, and have it very distributed and long-lasting, and, you know, it just solves so many problems, and you can scale up to whatever we need.
And in fact, the North Dakota legislature has talked about this very issue in this session, so it's very timely, and I think our readers will enjoy understanding his perspective on the potential and the future of nuclear power. The second article, will America's infrastructure have resilience to adapt to 21st century threats, from Dr. Craig Rieger. Very interesting in the attacks, et cetera, on not just your computer and my computer at home with our antivirus software, but of course, communications grids, power grids, and those things. And he writes about this.
And he's an engineer, not just an academic. It's, the resilience part of it is so important. I mean, if your internet goes down, or you have a company and it gets hacked and lose information, or you can't watch Netflix or whatever, it's no tragedy. But when we get into the systems that run energy, transportation, healthcare, you know, medical care, hospitals, these are existential threats, and the electrical grid. So being able, and you know, these things are going to get attacked. There's no doubt about that. But the question is, are they resilient enough to respond and stay online or recover very, very quickly?
He introduces polymorphic control systems in his article.
He's trying to, you know, reconfigure the architecture of these things such that they can be resilient. They're very complex, so I can't begin to explain the complexity. I mean, you've seen the graph. It's a maze.
But again, this is written in a way that I think it will be digestible, if you will, by nearly anyone who reads it, and it's such an important topic.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of the magazine, to take these complex technological issues and without dumbing it down, make it understandable.
Next article is a new approach to OT, and that stands for Operational Technology Cybersecurity, Engineered Solutions for Credible Threats. Again, this is an important topic, and it has to do with engineering-grade protections of cyber systems.
Yeah, it's the same arena and the same kinds of solution, engineering-grade. And the two authors are actually, they have a company up in Canada, but they do come down here and do work. The bottom line is, after 9/11, the focus on cyber attacks, et cetera, has been on the cybersecurity side of it, the IT side of it, which makes sense if you have a company where information is important. When we hear about that all the time, data breach, and people lose, you know, company loses, or at least hack into a million people's social security numbers and that, all of that sort of thing. So those cybersecurity systems are developed to protect the information. But the other side of it is operational technology. So the control systems that control and operations of a power plant, a refinery, and so on. And that's a totally different thing, because what you need to do is protect them from information, which can be a vector for hacking. And obviously, you know, a hacker gets in there, they can overheat the cracker in a refinery and it blows up. So if you're the cybersecurity guy, it's an existential threat to you and to the people who work there, and on a larger scale, the power grid and so on. So the question is, yes, any big infrastructure needs cybersecurity protection, but cybersecurity protection is a game of one-upmanship. You know, the hackers are always getting better, and it's always catching up, so there's always vulnerability. And what they've developed is an engineering solution, and the illustration he uses is a solar panel, where you put in two CPUs, and one of them is not connected to the internet, so it can't be hacked, and it can send information out, it can't take any in. So you can, if you're operating it from remotely, you can know there's a problem if there's a problem, but it can't be hacked because of an engineering solution.
My favorite article in this quarterly edition of Dakota Digital Review was written by Judge James Baker. And it's The Promise and Peril, Intro into AI and its Regulation for Public Citizens and Legislators.
Right. He spoke at the conference we hosted at Valley City State University last fall. So I talked to him, and he was willing to do an article. It's really a mini course for the rest of us outside of the cybersecurity, you know, and
democracy, economic systems, social issues, algorithmic biases.
Yeah. And just a note about who he is, he's the director of the Syracuse University Institute of Security, Policy, and Law. He served as a judge in the Data Protection Review Court. He's previously served as a judge and chief judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. He was also a Marine Corps guy and an aide to Senator Patrick Daniel Moynihan. So quite a quite a background. And you know, I would recommend everybody to read this because it's really a mini course. Takes you through what AI, a workable definition of what AI is, what the dilemmas are that faces as a society, and the fact that we can't let the people creating AI and running all the big tech companies make all the decisions, because they make them all in their favor, not ours. And AI, as Harari points out, is sort of intensely centralizing and sort of has a natural tendency towards authoritarianism by its very nature. So we need to get involved, make these decisions, and which is not easy. He calls it the centaur's dilemma, in that, you know, too much human control and we kill innovation, too little, and the innovators take over, and then you get outcomes that aren't necessarily good for the rest of us.
Enjoying our conversation with Patrick McCloskey. He's the editor of the Dakota Digital Review, which has published another edition. It is free and available online. Anyone can download it and read it and enjoy it. Next article I want to talk about is Balancing Privacy and Performance, GDPR Compliance in Blockchain Systems.
Well, to begin, Bridget, it's by Bridget Grathwohl, and she's a law student, so students can write in the publication. And I must say that when she turned in the first draft, it was extremely well written. Basically, the focus of the article is the conflict between blockchain. Yeah, it's distributed, and it's immutable, meaning once somebody initiates, they want to do a transaction in Bitcoin, which is what most people are familiar with, and that becomes part of the blockchain, and it involves a hash which is encrypted. So and then it's distributed throughout the blockchain, so it's on everyone's node. Everyone in that system becomes a node, which could be immensely large. So it becomes almost impossible to change or hack in any manner whatsoever, mm-hmm. which is its benefit, right? Which is why it can be used for blockchain. But there are privacy concerns, and the EU has recent regulations, and they want, you know, the right to be forgotten. But that conflicts with this technology because it's immutable. So how they're trying to figure out how to do workarounds, etc. But they're all far from perfect. And the thing about Europe is they're kind of pushing everyone towards digital IDs and CBDCs, which are inherently about blockchain. At the same time, they want these regulations that are impossible to fulfill. So we'll see how that all works out.
I've always wondered, Patrick, had AI been available to me as a college student, would I have used it to generate that essay in the class that I cared nothing about? And all of a sudden, here we go. Reflections are missteps with AI in the classroom, an educator's mm-hmm. reflection on learning, integrity, and societal impacts.
Yes, Professor Asadi. It's what he's noticed, which I'm sure probably everyone has noticed who's teaching, is there are students on the one hand, very diligent, do their work as students, and will use AI judiciously or just write it off altogether and said, no, I want to learn. And there are those who, you know, the path of least resistance, throw a prompt into ChatGPT or Grok and then just hand in what it spits out as their work. And, you know, these large language models have gotten pretty good and they're getting better. And now what he demonstrates is that a student who does their own work will do better in that they tend better to answer the question because they understand the question, they answer it. The large language models will churn out stuff that looks good, grammatically correct, but it's not really on target. Now, that's going to get better. We're still in the infancy of this stuff, so the problem's going to get more and more severe, and how do you tell and all that sort of thing. So on the one hand, we want to use technology. On the other hand, we want people to learn and master. And, you know, some solutions, I would teach writing, so I would have periodic tests or surprise tests with paper and pen. You know, if your eye doesn't match what you're handing in, you're in trouble, right? You know, I think, and all educators are dealing with this. How do we teach mastery at the same time in a world where all these technologies are available, right?
It's a good article for educators who have concerns about adapting these tools to their classroom.
And at the end, he talks about culture, and I think ultimately culture is the answer to a lot of these things, not rules, etc., because you can always get around rules. You know, like Joseph Campbell, in one of his books, makes the point about Americans and their rules. He said he went to, I guess, graduate school in England. He's playing rugby, and playing one day, and he threw a pass overhanded. And they said, oh, well, you can't do that. And he said, oh, is it against rules? I said, no, we just don't do it. So, we have to instill a culture where people just don't do certain things, because we can't run around and check all the time.
Reminds me of the current torpedo bat debate in Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
It's within the rules, right?
Yeah.
North Dakota needs skilled humans to advance AI.
Sure, what
a provocative title by Jeremy Straub.
And Jeremy teaches computer science at NDSU, and he's kind of laid out in the article. It's a pretty short article, so quick and easy read, but a lot of gems in there that, there are certain levels of people that are needed in industry. The people that use AI, technicians, developers, and then educators, and that these are different. And if you're going into the field, either as a person looking for a job or somebody going to hire, if you're a technician, for example, he said, you need to know how AI systems work and how to install and configure them, but you don't necessarily need to know how to make it perform from a system design and implementation perspective, meaning there are domains of knowledge you need to know to function as a user or as a technician, and they all go up. I mean, the developers are at the high end, but you don't need to know what the other people are doing necessarily to get hired and function there. And employers need to know that because the cost of hiring these people is much different. And then, of course, we're an educational institution, so what does it take to have people in the university system who can teach all these different levels, recognizing the fact that if they were out in industry, they'd make a lot more money. So how do we put together compensation packages such that we can actually attract good people? And that's a challenge because universities have been very resistant to, they want to kind of equalize when the market's telling you something different.
Last two articles, we've talked about both of these topics in detail on Main Street. The first, the rise of collegiate esports in North Dakota. This is a big deal, and it involves a lot of students in the state.
It does.
And I think that surprises some of us gray hairs when we start to learn about it.
Now, it's very interesting. The article's by a professor, Ethan Valentine, and a student. Well, she's not a student now, just graduated, Brianne Rumpel, and heads up the esports program at Minot State. It's booming, and it's booming all across society, and there are now esports clubs at high schools, universities, competitions, scholarships.
Scholarships?
Yeah.
To North Dakota schools.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of them that are available.
Yeah.
For esports, for gaming.
Right, and they're kind of, they've been denigrated as, well, they're kind of like athletic programs, but you just sit there sort of thing. But interestingly, they make health, wellness, as well as academics, part of the package.
These people are on a team.
Yeah, they're on a team. So there's all of the parts of what you would learn on a sports team integrated into it. But also they do make sure that people are getting some exercise as well. It's high-end intellectual stuff. Surprisingly, I mean, I've never actually played these games, but they are demanding. Interestingly, one of the big positives is they draw in a lot of people who would not otherwise go to university or certainly feel part of the university. A lot of guys who are kind of, I guess one would say, a little geeky or whatever.
Guys and gals.
Yeah, yeah. More women are coming in, but it was, that's sort of evening up. But anyway, these are people who might not connect with physical sports, who might not connect with other aspects of the university. They might be more loners, there's a whole range of people, but this gives them a community and attracts them as students and keeps them involved. And not only are there teams, which would be the best of, but there are intramurals, so there's a lot of people affected. And, so it attracts a lot of students in terms of recruitment and retainment at the universities. There's a lot of people who are now coming in and staying who would not otherwise be there.
Last article we'll talk about is one of the most interesting topics I've had the opportunity to discuss with our listeners on Main Street, from Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, and then the author of this article, Dr. Dennis Cooley from NDSU, Ghost Bots, Harmful or a New Afterlife. It blows my mind about what maybe some decisions my kids may want to make about how they can interact with me, and I'm using that in air quotes,
right,
after I'm dead and gone.
I know, it's, yeah. This kind of stuff pops up and you go, oh my God, where'd this come from?
Right, our digital footprint is there, and he talks about that.
That's true. This article, deals with whether or not ghost bots are harmful. And the case in point that begins the article is in 2006, this young high schooler was murdered by her boyfriend, and her father started a charity to help other women who are abused and so on. But then this character AI chatbot company came along and took her image and story and created this chatbot character as part of what they're doing online. And it's like, and the father found out, and of course he was very upset by this. I mean, they're just stealing her identity and making her into this character who she wasn't, and commodifying it for gain, et cetera, et cetera. So he did get them to withdraw it, but this is just starting. I mean, there's and they, of course, they can do it when you're alive, let alone when you're past, but you have less control when you're dead and gone. So Professor Cooley asks whether this is harmful or not. And his answer is, it depends. And it's a very complex article. I think part of the value of this is, yes, it's an intrinsically interesting subject, but it also brings people into thinking about things philosophically, which is different than legally and so on. And philosophy is less a part of education now than I think previously. So it's a good exercise that gives people analytic tools. And, you know, he distinguishes fundamentally between the embodied person, as we are now, right? And you know, that's not going to be digitally resurrected, but we have a socially embedded person, which is our interactions. You and I, writers, do podcasts, we leave all that behind, relationships, what people think of us. Digital trail, all that sort of thing is there that we've created and interacted with, and it's part of who we are. But that goes on in any case, right? It used to be on as long as people remember you, but now it can be rolled into a
chatbot.
And could have your voice and how you look.
My likeness, the whole thing.
Yeah. So then the question is, you know, is that okay? And well, of course, if you choose it, it is. Then, you know, but some people might not like. To do, you know, might want to have that done, but it's an ethical dilemma. If your kids want to do it and you didn't want to do it, then whatever. That's something else. Now, what one scenario is when you lose someone you love, perhaps creating a ghost bot for a period of time as part of grieving could be a good thing.
Lots to think about.
Yeah, lots to think about.
The publication is Dakota Digital Review. The Spring/Summer 2025 edition is out. Just Google it. You can download it, read the whole thing for free. It's available and it's understandable by layman. Patrick McCloskey's its editor. Thanks for joining us, Patrick, again
on
Main Street.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Still to come on Main Street, historic dam removals bring new life to the Klamath River, schools and farmers adjust after USDA food program cuts, plus legislative updates and cross-border conservation with insects. That's all ahead on Main Street after this.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez, and this is Our Living Lands. Last year, 4 dams on the Klamath River were removed. For Indigenous nations in Oregon and California, it was a victory decades in the making. It was the largest dam removal in U.S. history, and tribes are already seeing river health and salmon populations improving. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Grist reporter Anita Hofschneider about her reporting and how the dams came down.
Can you share some historical context on the Klamath River and its importance to the Indigenous tribes from that area?
The Klamath River in the Pacific Northwest is a 263-mile waterway that winds through the ancestral homelands of 5 Indigenous nations. And up until about 100 years ago, it was one of the largest salmon runs in the West Coast. I spoke with a man named Jeff Mitchell, who is part of the Klamath tribes, and he told me that generations ago, a fourth of his tribe's diet came from salmon. And then one day, a utility came and built a dam that blocked salmon from accessing the river upstream. And so it's hard to describe what salmon meant to Jeff's people, but what I can say is that it had an incredible importance to their food. It had incredible importance to their culture and spirituality. And in a blink of an eye, it was taken away.
The demolition of the 4 hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River, it's a huge win for these tribes in Oregon and California, especially being like, you know, a decades-long fight. How did the tribal leadership and advocacy play a role in making this dam removal a reality?
The dam removal that took place last fall is one of the biggest victories for Indigenous environmental justice in North American history. It was brought about because of the persistence of tribes and their allies across decades. In the beginning, it looked as if it would be an impossible task. And what the Klamath Dam Removal Campaign shows is what it takes to enact change, you know, across decades, and all the thousands of people who worked on this project, all the different tiny moments that led up to this point, how they all kind of came together to make this achievement happen.
And what was the most powerful story that you heard from any tribal members that you might have spoke to about the dam removal and what it means for them and their communities?
There was one man whose story didn't make it into the final piece whose experience still stuck with me. His name is Ron Reed, and he's a cultural biologist from the Karuk tribe. And Ron told me that to sit in those rooms and talk about dams kind of in the abstract, also knowing that his mom had passed away from a disease that she may not have received if salmon had been a big part of her diet, was a big turning point for him. It really helped him understand like what was at stake with this fight. And his contributions may not be always acknowledged or recognized, but who played an integral part in getting the dam removal to eventually happen.
And when you were doing this story, were there any conflicting perspectives either within, you know, the tribal community or non-tribal residents in that area?
One of the things that made the dam removal campaign successful was the willingness of tribes to put aside some of their historic differences and work together. And at the same time, over the long course of the campaign, there were several instances in which their perspectives diverged. For example, in the late 2000s, there was a negotiated settlement to remove the dams, and the Hupa tribe didn't agree with it. They thought that it let the utility off the hook for all the damage and harm that they had caused to their people and their ecosystem, and so they walked away. And so there were definitely times when people disagreed, and whether it was through protest, whether it was through, you know, legislative advocacy, there are so many, regardless of how it happened, people were moving towards the same goal, and that's how they were able to make this happen.
Is there anything else that you would like, you know, our listeners to know about this story and about the dam removal, and if you'd like to share anything, any last thoughts?
I think the last thought I would say is that this dam removal sets a new precedent for how the U.S. manages its water, and that's something that is extremely important as climate change continues to make water scarce in certain places and underscore the importance of managing our water. And it also represents the first real attempt at the kind of river restoration that Indigenous nations and environmentalists have long demanded. For so long, dam removal was seen as something that was impossible. And even though it's been happening more frequently in recent years, to have it occur at this scale is extremely significant. And I think for the people I've interviewed who worked really hard on it, that's something that they feel proud of.
That was Anita Hofschneider, who reports on Indigenous affairs for GRIST. You can read more about the Klamath Dams at grist.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Plains Art Museum in Fargo is hosting its Spring Gala 2025 Color Flings on Saturday, May 3rd from 7 p.m. until midnight, featuring food, wine tasting, art auction, and dancing into the night to Low Standards and Star 4. More information at plainsart.org.
What happened to that eminent domain bill that landowners were opposed to?
Are educational savings accounts moving ahead, or did that bill die?
This episode of In Session, we review where we're at and things we thought were off the table. Well, some of them are back on the burner. And what do you want to start off with?
Let's start with charter schools.
I thought they were dead in the water.
You're not wrong. House Bill 1358 did get killed, but the Senate bill, 2241, that did get a 40-7 vote, so quite overwhelmingly in favor of charter schools. And the way it works is that bill crossed over into the House. The House passed it by a 64-29 vote.
So the controversy over charter schools, in case you didn't read about this, is that it takes public money away from public schools, and in North Dakota, that would disproportionately
hurt rural areas where there are fewer or no private schools at all and where communities rely entirely on public schools for their kids.
Representative Longmire brought that up in the floor debate.
To say that this does not take money away from the public education is not correct. In my mind, we have one pie, and how the state slices that pie for the different programs. And if they slice a piece of that pie away to public charters, that takes it away from the public schools.
But it doesn't go to the governor for signature yet. It still has to return to the Senate because there were amendments, and the Senate will have to approve those.
Right.
Speaking of schools, thinking about books, what happened to Senate Bill 2307 and the one with the penalty if libraries are deemed to not be in compliance with moving objectionable materials?
So anything to do with appropriations, as in spending money, is very much held up right now. That bill is sitting in appropriations because, remember, it had $1 million price tag attached to it that would update the online search engine libraries use. It would have to be reconfigured to filter out the quote-unquote objectionable materials. It'll get a second reading in the House and then head over to the Senate.
Odin, right?
That's right. I'm impressed that you remember that.
Oh, yeah. Libraries. I've been there before. So sticking with the schools theme, and educational savings accounts, okay? So that's Senate Bill 2400 that started in the Senate. It would have appropriated funds to any student in North Dakota to put towards an account that addressed their education, say tutoring, mental health services, etc.
Also headed towards a second reading in the House.
Another bill that had money attached to it was 2069. It would have put money towards a website managed by the Secretary of State's office to post and host public notices as a backstop when newspapers don't publish in a timely fashion.
This one was a bit of a head scratcher because the North Dakota Newspaper Association already posts public notices online at ndpublicnotices.com.
Right.
So it would pay for a backstop to the backstop. And also the Secretary of State, Michael Howe, he testified against this bill.
Right. This was a bill from the Public Service Commission, and it had to do with a handful of public notices that weren't published in a timely fashion and prevented companies and businesses moving ahead with projects that cost millions of dollars. Always money.
Always money, and that means it will get a second reading in the House.
Okay, moving out of schools and into eminent domain. House Bill 1258 delivered a blow to landowners.
Yeah, it gives the Public Service Commission the ability to overrule a local ordinance they deem unreasonable. That's the word that's used in the bill. So like if a local government sends an ordinance that has a setback to be X number of feet from a transmission line, the commission could say, no, that's unreasonable.
And now it goes to Governor Armstrong for signature.
That's right.
Let's take a look at our numbers for the week. I'll start with one, a big fat zero, nil, as in no appeal for former state senator Ray Holmberg. I have to say that was a bit of a surprise. Maybe that's a bit of an understatement.
This was a shock last week. I checked in with Dane DeCray, a federal defense attorney. We interviewed him for a special legal analysis after the sentencing hearing where the judge sentenced the former state senator to 10 years for intent to travel for having sex with minors. And here's what he said in the email correspondence with me. Ray has an appeal right under the terms of the plea agreement. That is a matter of right, meaning the Eighth Circuit would have to hear it if he made it. And he gets to appeal even if he cannot afford a lawyer. So there is truly no reason not to appeal. And then at the end of the email correspondence with me, he did say, it does make me think something else might be going on behind the scenes. So stay tuned.
Anne, what's your number?
$20 million. That's how much money is not coming. The check is not in the mail to North Dakota as the result of cutting funds to BRIC, the Building Infrastructure and Resilient Communities Program. That was money from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
And there's a big question whether FEMA is even going to exist in its present federal form. What is your last number?
14. It's our 14th episode since the legislative session started. And so next week, we will do a special deep dive into the Ethics Commission.
Can't believe it's been 14 already, and it's been tons of fun so far, so stay tuned for that. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode of In Session. Tay Calloway is our radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager, and Leah Peterson is our digital communications specialist. I'm Eric Dethridge.
I'm Ann Alquist. We'll see you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by NoDak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at NoDakIns.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thousands of schools, farmers, and food pantries in the Midwest and Great Plains planned on federal dollars over the next year to support local food purchases. And then the U.S. Department of Agriculture cut the program. As Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, people across the supply chain are looking for ways to fill the gaps.
In a middle school kitchen, staff pull trays of baked potatoes out of the oven and dump them into serving pans. Julie Udelhoffen is a food service director for the Clear Lake Community School District in northern Iowa.
Today they're working on a potato bar, so they're getting the potatoes ready, the vegetables, cheese sauce, and we'll also have our salad bar they're getting ready.
Around the corner, staff cut up lettuce and mix in shredded carrots. A lot of the produce being served for lunch today, including the potatoes, came from farms within 200 miles of here. Udelhoffen says it started in 2022 with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Local Food for Schools program.
It just makes my heart so happy to see these kids with a tray full of beautiful food.
In October, the USDA said it was going to extend this program for another 3 years. Udelhoffen anticipated around $40,000 for the school district. She was planning to buy local beef and chicken. And then Donald Trump took office. The USDA, under new leadership, announced in early March it was ending the program.
Honestly, it made me a little sick to my stomach because I'm very passionate about local food for the kids. It's been tough.
Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins was asked about the USDA's decision to cut both the farm-to-school program and a separate farm-to-food bank program during an appearance on Fox News.
As we have always said, if we are making mistakes, we will own those mistakes and we will reconfigure. But right now, from what we are viewing, that program was non-essential, that it was a new program, and that it was an effort by the left to continue spending taxpayer dollars that were not necessary.
The timelines for pre-existing grants to run out varies state by state and by program. The effects have been more immediate in Iowa and Missouri, for instance, than Nebraska and Illinois. Liz Graznack owns Happy Hollow Farm near Columbia, Missouri. Graznack says demand from the USDA's local food purchasing programs helped her ramp up production. She hired more staff, bought a walk-in cooler, and new harvesting equipment.
I was providing so much produce through these two programs that it was about a quarter of my annual sales.
She says that's a huge loss for the certified organic farm.
The biggest hit is the fact that, you know, I have families that depend on me for working here, and they've been employees of mine for years, and I'm not going to be able to hire them this year.
Tough decisions are being made at farms and food banks across the Midwest. Tim Williams is with Food Bank for the Heartland, which serves 77 counties in Nebraska and 16 counties in western Iowa. He says the local food purchase assistance program was a win-win. The funding supported local farmers and helped the food bank meet the dietary needs of the people they serve.
By that not coming into the Heartland anymore, it's a big hit on growers and producers, but also people who are in desperate need at a time when groceries and inflation is on the rise that need access to these vital products.
Williams says Food Bank for the Heartland is committed to bringing in local food regardless of what programs are in place. Back at Clear Lake Middle School, students flow through the lunch line, filling their plates with colorful salads, golden potatoes, and fruit. Yes. Julie Udelhoffen says she's planning to contract with a few farms for the next academic year and will continue looking for more ways to buy local food as the budget allows.
I'm not going to let this kill the program for us. Yeah, this is too important.
Like other food service directors, she's planning the menus for the next school year with less certainty. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues. Main Street continues on this Tuesday here at Prairie Public. We're glad that you're with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. You may think that there are few areas of cooperation between the United States and Mexico right now, given the current climate of tariffs and deportations. However, there is a collaboration to protect nature through the charm of insect ambassadors, as we hear in another This Week in Water.
If you plan to visit the Butterfly Pavilion, a zoo just outside Denver, Colorado, prepare to see the place teeming with children, agog at being up close and personal with invertebrates, from tarantulas and worms to scorpions. There are, of course, butterflies, hundreds of them in many colors and sizes, fluttering about inside a massive greenhouse resembling a rainforest. Sublime childhood memories of nature, whether from a zoo or in the wild, can last a lifetime and be reawakened, as they were for a representative of the Mexican government when he visited the Butterfly Pavilion.
So I remember, I think that I was like 6 years. It was one of my most impressive images, in the sense that you see thousands, probably millions of butterflies just all over a forest. I'm Ricardo Ballesteros. I'm the Consul for Economic, Cultural, and Cooperation Affairs at the Consulate General of Mexico in Denver.
Ricardo's visit to the Butterfly Zoo was bittersweet. It reminded him of his trip long ago to the Monarch Butterfly Biosphere Reserve, about 2.5 hours west of Mexico City, where monarchs gather every winter after migrating from the U.S. and Canada. It also informed him about their falling numbers.
They confirmed me, the experts, about this reduction of the species, and that they are at risk, and that we have to take some action in order to protect them.
So when the idea was floated to form a partnership between the Butterfly Pavilion and the government of Mexico to help monarchs, he didn't hesitate.
Shiran told me, yes, let's do something.
Shiran is Shiran Hershkovich, the lepidopterist manager at the Butterfly Pavilion.
That's a fancy way of saying butterfly specialist or butterfly scientist, and basically Butterfly Pavilion's butterfly gal.
I've met Shiran in the same rainforest enclosure that Ricardo visited to hear how the monarchs are faring.
The migratory monarch butterfly has shown steep declines over the last couple of decades. The western monarch of over 90% and the eastern monarch of over 80%.
She says that pesticides and habitat loss are the main reasons, but climate change is also a factor, by potentially shifting when monarchs migrate and the availability of native plants as they make their 3,000-mile trek to and from Canada. If they do make it to Mexico, they'll find that the biosphere reserve Ricardo visited as a child has been reduced because of development and logging.
We have partnered with the government of Mexico to restore this very, very essential habitat for the monarch butterfly. It is estimated that less than 10% of its original range remains. So we will be planting 100,000 new oyamel fir trees in the Monarch Biosphere Reserve.
Scientists aren't sure why monarchs congregate on the limbs and bark of the oyamel fir trees, but perhaps they're drawn to its strong scent, or maybe because the area is volcanic with distinct minerals and compounds that might help guide them.
The monarchs use the magnetic fields created by this area to navigate. So they have this extremely carefully calibrated system of navigation that we are still trying to fully comprehend.
She says that in addition to planting the trees in Mexico this summer, they'll be installing pollinator plants in the buffer zone of the reserve to provide nectar that monarchs and other insects rely on.
They're so closely tied to their surrounding that when a habitat is damaged or degraded, butterflies are one of those first animals to show those signs of damage. So they might decline really rapidly.
Monarchs aren't the only species in decline. A study she co-authored last month found that in the last 20 years, we've lost over 20% of our butterflies in North America. That's devastating both from an ecological and social perspective, especially in Mexico, where the monarch migration has been woven into the culture because they arrive every year around Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, on November 1st.
One of the ways to explain it was that these are the souls of our loved ones returning for a visit into our earthly realm.
There might be something to this notion that butterflies want to communicate. As I talk with Sharon, a large female black and tan butterfly lays several eggs on my producer's sleeve and repeatedly lands on our microphone.
That is so funny. I've never seen this.
Well, perhaps it wants to tell us that over 200 species coexist in this space, sharing its resources without conflict. Or maybe it wants to say that despite news about tariffs and immigration, it thinks this new partnership between the U.S. and Mexico shows that butterfly diplomacy can transcend borders to protect nature. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 15th. A tattered mansion on 8th Street, which still stands today, was once home of U.S. Senator Porter J. McCumber of Wahpeton. 5 blocks north of the old silk stocking block is the Wahpeton Indian School, now known as the Circle of Nations. On this date in 1904, a bill introduced by Senator McCumber passed the House. According to a Fargo paper, an old sore in North Dakota's side will be healed when the Turtle Mountain Indians accept an appropriation of $1 million included in the Indian Appropriation Bill in payment for land taken by whites. Another paper noted the appropriation is much cause for rejoicing among the people of that town, and Senator McCumber will be hugged and kissed almost to death when he arrives home from Washington. The school will be as big a thing for Wahpeton as McCumber is for the state. For the Turtle Mountain Chippewa, however, the school was a poor trade for their lands. The 1892 McCumber Agreement, or 10-cent treaty, was signed under extreme duress. Their attorney, J.B. Botineau, son of famed surveyor and town founder Pierre Botineau, was not allowed in the proceedings. Starvation, epidemics, and poverty on the reservation ensured a steady enrollment of Turtle Mountain students at the Indian boarding schools. In 1909, it was reported that several hundred Turtle Mountain students would be transferred from the Morris, Minnesota school to Wahpeton. The experiences of students at Indian boarding schools varied. Some enjoyed the opportunity, while others didn't want to be there at all. Like other government schools, Wahpeton operated with military discipline and terminology. Farming, trade skills, and home economics were the main focus, but students also participated in musical instruction, marching bands, athletics, dance, and other community activities. The school's dairy farm was well known, though it ended after World War II. School lands were later acquired by local educational entities and athletic facilities after the farm program ended. In 1982, North Dakota's congressional delegation, with the support of community leaders, school officials, and alumni, successfully opposed the school's closure under the Reagan administration. In 1992, the school transferred to tribal control, chartered by the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merle Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
we'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's all for today's Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll preview one of two new exhibits that's now opened at the North Dakota Museum of Art in Grand Forks. We'll visit with artist Guy Nelson about his exhibit, Tales from the Understory. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.